Good afternoon. Welcome to Epicenter on KWMR, airing Monday through Thursday at 5 o'clock and featuring a wide array of local, community, and public affairs. I'm your host today, Lyons Filmer, and in the studio with me are two guests, Anna Dirksey and Stephen Swain, and they are connected with Knotweed. Anna and Stephen, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I first heard about Japanese knotweed a few years ago, and it was described as a really dreadfully noxious plant, far, far worse than it sounds like than anything else we've come across. And I'm a great hater of Erharta grass, which I pull at every opportunity. But one of the interesting things to me about knotweed, the Japanese knotweed, is those of you who know about it have said, don't you, homeowner or renter, try to pull out that plant. It will, in fact, make it grow even more. And you want to contact the right people. So first of all, we need to know how to identify it and who do we contact?
Yeah, so I work for, both Stephen and I work for UC Cooperative Extension, and we're part of a larger coalition of agencies and land managers called the Marin Knotweed Action Team. And my role as the Japanese Knotweed Outreach Coordinator is to talk with and work with private landowners who think that they have knotweed on their property and to find out if they have knotweed on their property. The thing with mechanical removal or stimulation of cutting or mowing is the plant is, one, very good at what it does, and it's very good at developing a rhizome network underground that can go out 20 feet and down 10 feet. And so when people try to cut it or mow it, that rhizome network is able to just continue to send energy up, and it doesn't successfully kill the plant. And in the process, very easy to inadvertently spread it.
Yeah, because it will spread from even just the tiniest little something.
So as small as a fingernail for the rhizome. And all it takes for the stem, and it's known as Japanese knotweed. The scientific name is Fallopia japonica, but it's also known by a variety of common names, including variants of fleece flower and false bamboo.
Oh.
And the stem, which can also spread the plant if there's stem material that's washed downstream, and there's a node on that stem that can create a new stand as well. And that stem looks like a bamboo stem.
So potentially harmless. Ha, ha, ha. What does this plant do that makes it so risky for us to mess with it? Why are we so concerned?
Why are we concerned? So it's a very aggressive plant. And in terms of its able to very quickly crowd out other plants and establish itself and create a monoculture. And because it has all that energy in that rhizome network, in the spring it's able to outcompete other plants and native plants as they're coming up. In addition, it ends up creating, similar to black walnut and eucalyptus, an allopathic toxin is exuded and prevents seedlings from regeneration as well.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's just a bad actor in the general scheme of things.
Yes.
And because it likes wet areas and grows along creeks and riparian areas, it's very easily spread through flood events. That's our main concern is that, you know, if you have a stand along a river bank, all it takes is for, you know, one rain event and all of a sudden you have 10 stands down, farther downstream.
Partly because it dies back in the winter. So all that stuff that's shading out all the plants in the summer just goes away right about the same time that the rains come. So floodwaters just go streaming down without anything really to slow them like native vegetation does.
Right.
And so, and it's almost by quote unquote design or evolution because it, in those big flood events, there's a lot of scouring, so the little pieces of the rhizome can break off and then spread farther downstream and keep reproducing the plant. So it's an ecosystem engineer. It engineers the ecosystem to erode more readily than it otherwise would so that it can spread across the landscape.
Yes. And presumably that was a fine thing in its original home. Yes? Question mark.
Well, it acts differently is what, from my research into it, is it just there's different factors that are in play, including that it's usually coming after a volcanic event and actually colonizing volcanic rock.
Goodness.
So it's not very, you know, high quality soil.
Yeah.
And then, as well as in Japan, it exhibits different growing tendencies and actually dies back in the center of the plant. It allows other plants to come in afterwards, but it doesn't appear to do that here.
Mm-hmm.
As well as there's some biological factors and a psyllid, Aphalara itadori, which helps keep it in check.
Please translate.
So it's like a plant lice, basically. It sucks the sap from the plant, but it's a little flying insect.
Thank you.
And then the other, there's a leaf spot fungus that helps keep it. So there's a variety of different things that help suppress it to prevent it from going out of control and taking over ecosystems.
But those are in its original
That's
home.
In Japan.
Right.
In Southeast Asia.
And they've been introduced to England, and they're fast-tracking the introduction of these things into the United States in the hopes that they can offer some control. But as of right now, they're not here.
The biological control of a psyllid.
Great. And whatever the fungus you said that does the leaf spot, is it a fungus?
I don't know that the fungus has actually gotten through U.S. EPA permission. I know the psyllid is in the process.
Okay.
But, and they're taking comments on it sometime in the next 30 days, I believe. But I don't know how much longer the process is after that.
Uh-huh.
But with any luck.
And, of course, we know that sometimes things that are introduced to deal with one pest invasion end up causing problems of their own. Do we have any idea whether this psyllid, have they had success with it in England without it carrying on in
there,
some bad
I know,
way?
I was just looking, had difficulty overwintering it, mm-hmm. and they released it a few years ago, and it's still something that they're sort of looking into how effective it was. But in England especially, there's just so much more knotweed that I mean, things like the hopes of eradication, which is what we're trying to do here in Marin County and the San Geronimo Valley, is not even feasible. It's really how do we control or manage in the same way that, you know, broom and other invasive or non-native species here, we don't have the hopes of eradication because it's too far gone.
Yeah.
But we believe that the population size in it's been found in Lagunitas Creek and San Geronimo Creek, Japanese knotweed has, that those populations are small enough and that we've caught them soon enough that it's possible to eradicate.
All right. I want to get on to that, but I want to just take a moment and remind you, dear listener, this is KWMR, West Marin Community Radio. I'm Lyons Filmer, hosting Epicenter. And in the studio with me are Anna Dirksy, who is the Japanese Knotweed Outreach Coordinator on the Marin Knotweed Action Team, and Stephen Swain, who's a farm advisor with UC Cooperative Extension, with a lot of background in plant pathology and integrated pest management and all kinds of goodies. So I love that you said you have been sentenced to serve on the Marin County IPM Commission. I'm glad you're there.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. And Anna, I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. So if someone, where's the best place that a person can go to get a picture of what Japanese knotweed looks like?
So if you go to our website, basically if you Google Marin Knotweed Action Team and Japanese knotweed, the first thing that should pop up should be the ucanr.edu website. And there's ID guides and more information as far as who to contact, which is myself, if you think you've seen it. And the plant itself, I'll say it, it's a pretty looking plant. I think it was originally brought over as an ornamental because it's pretty, and it has large, about the size of a palm of a hand, sort of heart-shaped leaves that have a flat edge where it connects to the stem. And then it has this really distinctive zigzag to the stem as well. So once it emerges, it starts out looking in the very, very early spring like little red asparagus tips. But once it grows, and it can grow, basically it goes from zero after having died back in the fall to over 8 to 10 feet tall in ideal growing conditions.
8 to 10 feet.
So that's why, like I said, the concerns around outcompeting other vegetation and native species is that incredible growth. It will start, depending, you can see smaller specimens as well, but the shape of the leaf and that zigzag are very distinctive.
Mm-hmm. Although it isn't that hard to mix up with some of the natives. So we have gotten quite a few calls over pipevine, which looks a lot like it, but it's got a heart-shaped base, sort of, and a few other.
Elk clover is another. Elk clover has the serrated edge, is a good way of telling it apart from Japanese knotweed, because Japanese knotweed has a smooth edge to the leaf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are a few plants that, you know, from a distance especially.
All right, let's say I go to the website, knotweed, Marin Knotweed Action Team, Japanese knotweed.
Masks and capes are optional.
Okay, I'm into that. And I get a look at the pictures, and then I go out in my yard, and I think, oh my God, is that it? Could I take a picture and email it to you?
That's exactly what we suggest, is that you take a photo, include your contact information and location information, and then you can email me. My email's acdirkse@ucanr.edu. That's all on the website as well. And that's really, the first step. Or feel free to email me and say, hey, can you maybe come by and stop and check it out if you can't get a photo of it. I'm also more than happy to do that.
And it would seem that, well, excuse me, I'm not sure where I wanted to take that thought, so I'll move along. Marin Knotweed Action Team, and that's the place to go. That's the place to find Anna Dirkse, D-I-R-K-S-E. What are the general points that you'd like people listening or have otherwise become aware of Japanese knotweed? What would you like them to understand or know?
Yeah, so Japanese knotweed is classed as a Class A noxious weed because of its invasive tendencies and the fact that there isn't that much in the state to begin with. That so there's rules of as far as whether it can be brought into the state or moved around. And so it shouldn't be collected or harvested is one, you know, thing that we're trying to get across to people, as well as the fact of the matter is that it's important for us to have a general sense of the population. So that's why we're asking homeowners not to necessarily tackle it themselves. And I know there's a lot of that sort of initiative in West Marin to do that, and it's understandable. But the hope is that, you know, by having us do it in a concerted manner, we're able to look at it and tackle it from a watershed perspective, because it is something that impacts the whole watershed, the Tomales Bay watershed, Lagunitas Creek and San Jeronimo Creek. And if we don't work together, it's just something that it's going to be that much harder to get rid of. And the other thing is that it doesn't necessarily respond in the same way as Erhardia or broom, or things where you can pull and mulch. It does need to be treated with an aquatically approved herbicide, and that's something that we have the funding to provide at no cost for homeowners. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, we want to make sure that is done in a safe manner because it is so close to the creek. Yes. And so that's especially one reason why we don't want homeowners to take things into their own hands, for those reasons.
And we also just want to know where it is. Yeah. So we have some idea of where it's coming from and where it's going to. And we have some idea of whether we're being successful and the work we're doing. And it's not just us. The Marin Knotweed Action Team is a coalition of a whole bunch of different landowners in the West Marin, so that includes national parks and state parks and Marin Municipal Water District and a bunch of other people, and we all have a hand in managing this, and it costs money to manage, and the consequences of the increased erosion, our potential loss of salmon habitat, potential loss of structures and foundations along the creek beds and things like that. So, I mean, everybody has a stake in controlling this. And if we have actors that are, you know, folks that are trying to manage it on their own and not telling anybody else where it is, if they're not successful, then that makes everybody else's work just kind of a waste of time. So we're hoping that folks will let us at least just see where it is. That's the first step, mm-hmm. you know, figure out what, wrap our heads around what the scope of the problem really is.
Mm-hmm. So as best as is known, there are sites on the creeks in Lagunitas, as you've described. Do we know of other populations of Japanese knotweed elsewhere in Marin or the Greater Bay Area?
The Greater Bay Area, if you go on CalFlora, you can see some in San Francisco and East Bay, some reports of other people. It's not confirmed that it's in Sonoma, and we don't know that it's anywhere else in Marin currently. But it is something that's very easily, you know, all it takes is one person to move a plant and put it in a location where then it's spread easily through floods and that sort of thing. And that's really, you know, it's the cultural side of things as far as how we move plants and people around these days is there's a lot of movement. And it's important for people to think and sort of realize that that impacts the ecosystems around them. And in the case of, we didn't really mention this, Stephen touched on it, as far as Japanese knotweed can do significant damage to infrastructure, including septic systems and people's foundations, and can grow through cracks in concrete and end up in people's houses. If you Google UK Japanese knotweed,
you'll see it coming up through people's light sockets and stuff. Yeah, it's kind of frightening.
It really does sound like the monster plant, the equivalent to Jaws in the fauna world. The flora world. So anybody who suspects that there may be some knotweed, Japanese knotweed, on their property, contact the Marin Knotweed Action Team, and that will get you specifically to Anna Dirksy, who's the outreach coordinator. Send a picture, take a picture on your phone and email it. You say it's something about we'd like landowners to allow us to survey their property. So that I assume is if somebody sends you a picture, then you ask, can we come out and see?
Yeah, so it's both people who think that they've seen it, and we've also been doing a larger outreach campaign that's involved letters to creekside property owners and door knocking as well, because we need to get everybody on board.
Yeah. Okay, so you've been doing cold calls, if you will.
And trying to, you know, both have events in the community as far as education, but also just, you know, get in contact with every single creekside landowner. And that's a work in progress currently.
So is it really that much in love with the water that it is really limited to creeksides? You're not likely, I'm wondering, am I likely to find it on a dry hillside, for instance, along with the Erharta grass?
No, you're not likely to find it there, but people have planted it in the past as an ornamental because it is a very attractive plant. Yeah. So if they put it there, it will persist there for a long time, although it doesn't typically spread very well or even do very well on a dry hillside. Mm-hmm. So it may not be quite as lush and beautiful as one might want. You give it lots of water, which is not an ideal thing for a California plant.
No,
you know, an ornamental.
Anyway.
Right, yeah, exactly. You plant it right in the stream, it thrives, you know, but...
I think about people who've come to California and not known what poison oak looked like. And, you know, it's so beautiful in the fall with its colors, and cutting some and bringing it in the house and later regretting it. It sounds like the Japanese knotweed might be an attractive enough plant that you'd want to cut some and bring it in the house and then maybe later put it in your compost heap. And I assume that would be equally problematic.
Yeah, so it is one thing that, like I said, any fragment of the plant, whether that be rhizome material or the stem, can create a new stand. So especially the putting into compost. It needs to be disposed of in a landfill or in a proper facility or burned, ideally.
Wow.
And we do know people who've actually brought it in their houses and draped it up along the walls because it's so pretty, you know.
The dried parts, though.
Well, yeah, dried there. So, yeah, it's attractive even when it's dried.
Yeah. Stephen Swain is a farm advisor. He's part of the environmental horticulture advising folks of the Marin and Sonoma counties as part of UC. Well, your UCANR, Natural Resources.
Yeah, but I mean, that's
related
just an internal division name. We're
okay.
Cooperative Extension.
Cooperative Extension.
Yeah, exactly.
I love the Cooperative Extension. That's such a brilliant thing that got started these many decades ago. Anna Dirksy is the Japanese Knotweed Outreach Coordinator, and she's with UC Cooperative Extension Marin. And I'm going to read your email off, Anna, A.C. Dirksy, that's D-I-R-K-S-E, at ucanr.edu. Phone number? Should we give out your phone number?
So it's 415-473-6070.
And I imagine if I'm out pulling Erharta somewhere and I come across what I think might be the knotweed, it could be on public land or on my landlady's property, I should take a picture and give you a call, send you an email.
That would be great.
Yeah. How does it's almost unbelievable to think of it, you know, crawling up through concrete and in through people's light switches and so on. It really is damaging. It really can be damaging. I'm beginning to sort of get that.
I like to say that it's a powerful plant. And it's good at what it does. And I have a lot of respect for it in that way.
It's beautiful. It's powerful. It's got a lot of good things going for it. And it's on a Japanese island, volcanic island, out in the South Pacific. It's a good thing. Just
here,
not here.
Yeah, not so much. it's one of those things where it can lay dormant for many years under actually volcanic rock in Japan originally. And so it's until it's those conditions are right and it will emerge. So it's something, it's a tricky plant to manage. And there's been a lot of work done in other areas. The Pacific Northwest and Northeast has significant populations of it. And so a lot of the experiences from those places are what we're drawing on in our work here. Because it's something that if we let it go, there's a great risk that we won't be able to ever come back from that and actually get rid of it if we don't get on it.
Well, we still have a few more minutes left. I'm a little hesitant to ask you for horror stories, but what have you encountered with the public, let's say, when describing the Japanese knotweed and what it's capable of? Are people responding? Are you getting information from people on? Have you found any more based on people reporting it?
Yeah, so I just actually had a phone call a couple of days ago, and I was just out this morning looking at someone's property where they had, luckily, a small patch, a single plant of it, but they had seen it and they had called. I've seen it growing under people's decks and towards their foundation. I think that's the scariest sort of in terms of worst case scenario that I've seen so far here in the valley. But I think I've seen it elsewhere where it's on the scale of quarter acre, half acre, or, you know, things where it's on both sides of a riverbank, as far as the eye can see, sort of things where that's what we really want to avoid.
Yeah.
And luckily, I haven't, you know, seen anything to that extent. We have some large patches, but nothing of the sort that's being dealt with in other places.
Well, what is occurring to me is that for anyone who owns a house or property or maybe rents and you're in charge of it, that the kinds of things that you would do, you know, check that the gutters aren't filled with leaves before winter, check that you don't have highly flammable plants within 30 feet of your house or 100 feet of your house, that this looking for the Japanese knotweed, checking under the deck or under the porch or whatever, you know, that can be, in effect, simply added to household tasks that you would do to take care of anything else for maintaining the place you live.
Or heck, it doesn't even have to be a chore. I mean, if you just get familiar with it, and next time you're out dabbling your feet in the stream on a nice hot day like today, take a look around you and see if you see it. I mean, I think that's where half of this stuff gets found, is people are like, oh, yeah, I was just walking by the thing, and I thought, huh, that looks a little like the picture I saw. And, you know, there. The other thing is in the midsummer, it'll produce these nice fleecy flowers that are white, and the bees love them. And that's another. I mean, if you're into bees, you know, you'll pay attention to that. And unfortunately, the bees love it, so that creates a little bit of a problem. But
we have many other things that bees love that we can plant.
That's true. We can simply put something else in that's a little more, sustainable.
I can recommend the Salvia Bees Bliss.
Yeah.
It's a nice, low-growing, gorgeous purpley-blue flower, bluey flower.
And they'll
and the
go,
bees love it.
Yeah, and salvias will grow. You can find a salvia that'll grow almost anywhere in California.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Stephen Swain and Anna Dirksy, I really appreciate you coming in and helping us understand better about Japanese knotweed. So in terms of resources, where we want to send people, Anna, and where?
So the UCANR website, if you Google Marin Knotweed Action Team and Japanese knotweed, it'll pop up. And that has lots of information about the plant, what to do if you find it, as well as if you are a creekside homeowner and you've maybe gotten a letter in the mail and maybe haven't returned it because you wanted to know more. You can also fill out a survey, permission to survey form there that will get me in contact with you to survey your property.
Great. Stephen Swain, anything you'd like to add on a contact or where people might get more information about something?
Well, you know, there are a lot. Oregon and Washington both have similar things. And actually, even Alaska, Juneau, Alaska, the area has flyers and publications, or you can find their websites on Japanese knotweed, and it can be reasonably informative. Of course, you know, Marin isn't Alaska, so there are going to be some differences, and there's some regulatory differences as well. And it's so bad in Washington, they're not working on an eradication campaign. So there's some important differences, too. Mm-hmm. But the biology of the plant hasn't changed all that much, you know. And actually, England can be rather informative, even if we want to be really look at the Little Shop of Horrors kind of scenario.
Well, Anna mentioned Google UK Japanese knotweed.
And that's, if you want to get scared.
Thank you, Anna Dirksy and Stephen Swain, for coming in.
Thank you.
You, dear listener, please stay tuned to KWMR. That's it for Epicenter today. Every Monday through Thursday, you can find Epicenter on KWMR Point Reyes Station. If you have an idea for a topic you'd like us to put attention on, please email me, programming@kwmr.org. I'm Lyons Filmer. Thanks for being with me today on Epicenter. Stay tuned.